Good morning, New Mexico, and welcome to the Santa Fe Radio Cafe. My name is Mary Charlotte. We're broadcasting live from the Santa Fe Baking Company on Cordova Road and streaming on the web at ksfr.org. We're also podcasting. The website is santafe.radiocafe.org, where you can listen to the show anytime you want, thanks to Santa Fe's Dotfoil Computer Services. And you can also subscribe to the show on iTunes. Later on in the program, we're going to be speaking to Juan Manuel Echevarria, who's opening at the Santa Fe Art Institute just took place for a show called Bocas de Ceniza, Mouths of Ash. And we're also going to be speaking briefly with some of the folks from Amigos del Parque. Right now, I would like to welcome Nancy Zeckendorf. She's president of the Lenzic Performing Arts Center Board of Directors, and Mark Tiarx. He's the director of planning and marketing at the Santa Fe Opera. And we're here to talk about an amazing event coming up live in high definition from the Met. Welcome.
Thank you
very much.
Now, this is I'm shuffling through my unorganized papers here. Metropolitan Opera live in high definition. So we're going to have opera not just in the summer.
That's right. There are 8 broadcasts from the Metropolitan Opera that will be screened at the Lenzic Theater as part of the Met's live in HD broadcast series, which is now actually going around the world. But this will be the first. They started last year, and they were broadcast to Albuquerque, but not Santa Fe. So this year we're very excited that they will be screened at the Lenzic Theater.
In high definition.
Yes, and if you haven't seen high definition, you may think you've seen high definition by looking at your television set at home. But until you see high definition on our screen, which is the largest screen in the Southwest, or any screen of that size, you just cannot believe what it looks like. It is a whole new art form. It is just incredible. It's very hard to explain to anyone. You have to come see it to really understand what a unique new technology this is.
And so they're going to be broadcasting operas. Are they really live?
Yes, they are.
And so
they're
very live. Yes. So somebody's going to fall off the bed, which I think they did in the opening of Romeo and Juliet. You're going to see it.
Mm-hmm.
It's everything. It's a live performance. And actually, it starts with a half hour before, when the doors at the Metropolitan Opera open. You will see people walking into the auditorium. You will see the orchestra warming up. You will see the chandeliers go up, so you will have that whole experience as if you were sitting in the Metropolitan Opera. In other words, you can subscribe to the Metropolitan Opera and live in Santa Fe, New Mexico. How's that?
And it is a series of, eight different performances starting in December. The Saturday, are they always on Saturdays? No, they're Saturdays.
Yes, they are, because except for
one, which is on Tuesday,
Year's Day. Yeah, that's Tuesday, but they're because it's when the Metropolitan Opera does its Saturday broadcasts.
And so, I think one of the things that's interesting about this is when you are at the opera here or anybody else, any place else live, you're watching the stage, and that's the view you see. When somebody else is operating the camera, you're seeing a broadcast. They can, they can zoom in on the tonsils of the singer, or they can have the whole stage. Who is making those decisions about what it looks like?
Well, there's a telecast director, essentially, and they rehearse the broadcasts because they use a large number of cameras.
I think
8 or 10
different cameras from all different, and then they pull it together when it goes over the air.
It's like a football game in some ways,
right,
where there's somebody in the truck, basically, who's looking at 10 different screens saying, this is what we want to see. And is giving directions to the cameramen at the same time, or women, about what else they should be looking for.
But no replays.
There are no instant replays yet.
No. But you will see things that you would never, ever see in the theater. And it's an experience that a lot of people who have seen it said, well, this is better than the real thing. It's a terrible thing to say, but even very experienced people are just amazed.
Well, what about the sound?
The detail. The sound is something called Dolby 5.1. Now, Mark, if you can explain what it's surround sound.
It's the latest iteration in surround sound. So it really is a different experience than being in the theater itself, because the sound is surround sound, and you're able to watch the intimate scenes, the arias and the duets, as close-ups, but the big celebratory scenes or the party scenes kind of in a wide stage format. So it really is like having the best five or six seats in the house rather than one seat.
Even better, because as a friend of mine said, wait till you see Romeo and Juliet in the bed suspended 12 feet above the stage. That's a moving bed, and they're both in nightdresses. And they're moving around, she said. So you won't see that even from the first row because this is taken from above.
Right, right. Well, there's something, I mean, when film first came to be a medium, basically you saw what were essentially stage plays mm-hmm. on film, and then people started to discover the possibilities of the medium. This is, you really are filming a stage play. Are they staging it differently?
No. It's exactly the way it is.
No, it's exactly as you would see it in, if it weren't being broadcast.
Yeah,
they
right.
So they're not doing extra special effects for the broadcast.
No.
So if you're at the Metropolitan Museum, you don't. It's not like there's going to be cameras swooping in front of your nose when you're in the audience. I mean, the Metropolitan Opera.
No, you won't. And if you were sitting in the theater, you're not aware of all this going on. That's the great technology today, that they can do that without interfering with the audience. The audience isn't aware of what people are filming.
So we're talking to Nancy Zeckendorf and Mark Tjarx about opera in high definition, Metropolitan Opera live in high definition. So this starts in
December.
December, the 15th of December, and runs through the spring. Are you actually offering a subscription where people can go to all of them?
Yes, we offered a subscription, and then we offered a subscription of four, but of course you can always go and buy single tickets. But the wonderful thing about this is for everyone, tickets are $20 for adults, or $22
for adults. Actually, we don't talk about prices on the air normally.
But, but I mean, there's a very, very affordable way to see opera, which you can't anywhere else.
So what is the participation of the Santa Fe Opera in this?
Well, the Santa Fe Opera is collaborating with the Lensic on this. We helped acquire some of the
They made it happen.
And some of the hardware and software necessary to do the download, because it's a satellite transmission. And we also helped rebuild the screen.
The screen.
And we're assisting with some of the marketing and promotion of it. And I think it really is all part of the general director, Richard Gaddis's sensibility that we wanted to be involved in different ways with the community of Santa Fe throughout the season and not just doing a summer season of opera up on the hill. So it's very much a part of that aspect of the company's mission and Richard's particular passion for this kind of community project.
Now, this has been done before. This is obviously not the first time that it's been done. Sometimes I just finished watching a whole bunch of films at the Santa Fe Film Festival this weekend, and there's always that moment where the screen goes blue and there's a little thing that says DVD reboot or some horrible error message. Does that kind of thing happen?
We hope not.
They said last year was the first time they did this, actually. It is a very new thing. And I understand that, you know, a few places there were a few glitches, and we might have one or two in the beginning, too, because there's a lot of technical stuff that has to happen, excuse me, to bring this in. But I would like to say that I need to give more credit to the opera than Mark is taking credit for, because without the help of the Santa Fe Opera, I don't think the Metropolitan Opera would have paid that much attention to the Lensic Performing Arts Center, because there were many other theaters, they're being done in movie theaters. But through the help of the board president, Richard, and some arm twisting, they made it happen for us here in Santa Fe, which is wonderful, because we have reserved seats instead of just going into a theater and finding a place to sit. You don't get popcorn.
You don't get popcorn. The sound of chewing will not obscure your...
will not obscure Mimi's dying. You know?
That's right.
But it's a great thing to be able to see this in a theater like the
Yes,
Lensic,
it's more like being in an opera theater than being in a mall.
Right.
It's a little more attractive.
That's right.
Now, I just have to ask, this is such a silly question, but how big is the screen?
Big.
It's big. I mean, my husband will be upset with me for not getting it. It is the largest screen in the Southwest. I mean, it's bigger than the screens at the Regal Theaters, and you know what those are like. So my answer to that, I knew you were going to ask me and I don't, but it's huge. It's the whole size of the whole opening of the Lensic stage.
Okay.
You know what
it spans the proscenium.
It spans the proscenium.
That's pretty big.
And the first opera on Saturday the 15th is Romeo and Juliet.
Yes.
And are you marketing, I mean, are you advertising, is it a draw which singer it's going to be? Is that part of the deal?
Well, I think for opera fans, it certainly is. And this one has two really wonderful singers who also happen to be not only great singers, but extraordinarily good actors and very good-looking people. So the idea that they are a young couple in love is totally believable.
It's, they're not 48 years old instead of the 16 that they're supposed to be.
Exactly.
Well, they might be, but they look 16. But Peter Gelb, who started this whole thing, who is the general manager of the Metropolitan Opera, is trying to bring another aspect to opera to attract new people, which is singers who can really act and who are wonderful to look at as well as wonderful to hear. And that's what's happening in all of these telecasts, including Tristan, which is 5 hours, and it's going to be fantastic.
Well, that's another thing, is that because we don't have an altitude problem, we can do Wagner here.
Right. That's
well, also the challenge we have with Wagner is that
the time.
The starting time, since it's governed by sunset.
Right. Oh, that's the problem with Wagner. I thought it was the oxygen.
No, it's not the oxygen.
It's
more the fact that you could stop for breakfast on your way into town after the show is over.
That's right. And being a town where all restaurant kitchens close at about 7:30.
Yes, it's tough.
These, of course, are the matinee performances from the Met, which means that the starting times are progressively earlier as you work your way across the country. So they begin in the late mornings here.
Oh,
11 or
11:30. 11 a.m. or
11:30. You don't have to stay up late.
Ah, yes. For those
who like
to. You can
go to dinner after the opera.
and the restaurant will still be open. So we have Romeo and Juliet, Hansel and Gretel, and then Macbeth in January. And let's see. How do you pronounce the Puccini?
Manon Lescaut.
Right. What's that one about?
Oh, it's about a prostitute gets sent to Louisiana. Yeah. I was once a...
It's the doomed love affair of Manon Lescaut for Desgrieux, the young nobleman.
Uh-huh. It's very popular, by the way. It's the next most popular seller for us after Romeo and Juliet. So it's a beautiful opera.
And then Peter Grimes is in March, and then later in March, Tristan and Isolde. Then La Bohème, everybody's favorite, or one of their favorites, which was at the Santa Fe Opera last summer in April, and then later in April...
La Fille de Régiment.
Thank you.
The Daughter of the
Regiment, which is going to be smashing. And Natalie Dessay, who was a favorite now of the Santa Fe Opera and Santa Fe, and is performing in that, and it will be... the smash hit of the season. Don't miss it.
She's a terrific comedian.
Yes.
In addition to being a wonderful performer in serious roles, she's a fabulous comedian, and it's very much a comic piece.
And a slight little slip of a lady.
Of a thing.
Yes, tiny, tiny.
She is teeny tiny. It's also a famous opera in part because of the tenor. Tonio has this fabulous aria, A Mes Amis, with 9 high Cs. And it's one of the calling cards for a tenor. It's the piece that Pavarotti sang early on in his career.
I was there really when he opened with it, but then I was
You
not
must have
there.
Been a babe in arms.
I had already graduated from the Met by then, but then he came back and tried to do it again, and it didn't work, and it was very tragic. I mean, he couldn't make it. So hopefully this tenor is going to not have any trouble, but it's a very exciting piece.
Juan Diego Flores is the tenor, and it's an ideal piece for him. He's a great singer of that kind of role.
So this is all about the Metropolitan Opera live in high definition series at the Lenzic starting on the 15th of December. Anything else that the public should know before we go?
We're also having a little brunch. We're not sponsoring it, but the San Francisco Bar and Grill is going to have, we're going to have a brunch before because this starts so early and because it goes through lunch hour. And
a tailgate isn't really going to work.
A tailgate isn't going to work down on San Francisco Street, but we wanted
in
to.
In the cold.
So, and then there'll be a opera talk for maybe 10 or 15 minutes before. And then we're also going to have
By
Desiree Mays. And we may then also, we're trying to arrange to have sandwiches and other things. The Metropolitan Opera suggested that since this doesn't maybe get out till 3 o'clock in intermissions, you may have to have something more substantial than a cup of coffee.
How very true. Taking care of the culinary needs and blood sugar needs of the audience.
I think the only other thing just about the first broadcast, especially Romeo and Juliet, by Charles Gounod, who wrote Faust also, and it's a score that has some wonderful arias, but especially what he did that was really in some ways very brilliant was use it as an opportunity to write four really fabulous duets for the soprano and the tenor, the Romeo and Juliet. So the piece really is this succession of fabulous duets as they fall in love and their relationship develops. So it really kind of highlights, showcases the soprano and tenor, the Romeo and Juliet, as in the story and in the nature of the opera.
So after having organized all of this and done all this work, are you going to be able to enjoy the operas yourselves?
Of course.
Oh, absolutely. Absolutely.
We get to have a good time.
I have to say, I mean, what do you think, if you're sitting in the front row and the screen is the size of the entire proscenium, is that really the best seat? What do you think is the best seat?
I think it's really a personal consideration. There's some people who love to be up close. There's some people who can't stand it. So it really is much more a sort of...
It's an interesting question. I sat in the front two rows while we were doing a test, and actually it's fine. I mean, people in the movie theaters go sit in the front rows. I mean, you may not want to. But it's not distorted, nor is it far on the side. So it's amazingly clear, even though you're very, very close.
Well, that's what makes high definition so amazing.
Yes, yes, it doesn't.
The clarity of what you see is so astonishing from wherever you are.
You can see every jewel. You can see every little mole. As you said, you can see the tonsils. Everybody's got to look very good. I think a lot of plastic surgeons are going to be very busy with this new technique.
Oh, goodness. Well, Nancy Zeckendorf and Mark Tiark, I would like to thank you so much for being with us here on the Santa Fe Radio Cafe.
Thank you, Mary Charlotte.
Our pleasure.
Once again, the Metropolitan Opera live in high definition starts Saturday, December 15th, 11 in the morning. 988-1234 is the Lenzig box office. For many of our listeners, that's already engraved on the inside of your mind because you sell the tickets for almost everything that's happening in town.
Ticket sales are going very, very well.
Do you think it's going to be sold out?
Romeo and Juliet will be sold out.
Uh-huh. All right. Well, there you have it. And thank you so much for coming in at this early hour.
Thank you.
Thank you.
We're going to take a little break right now. Stay tuned to KSFR. I'd like to welcome now Mara Taub. She is a prisoners' rights and immigration rights activist. And Rafael Escamilla, who's a health educator and community activist. And Alvaro Holguin. He is a business person from Mexico. And he runs a wonderful salon down on Cerrillos Road. Welcome, ladies and gentlemen. Bienvenidos.
Gracias.
So we were here last year briefly talking about an event which is happening again this year, Las Posadas Navideñas, which is a week from today at the Agua Fria School. Mara, what's this all about?
This is a Christmas party for the men who work for day labor down in the park in front of Guadalupe Church. This is our seventh year, and we're here today to again ask the help of this most generous community in being able to supply everybody with decent winter clothes. I just came from the park. There are guys down there with just sweatshirts on. Although there are always miracles in the park, and someone we didn't know pulled up and started serving pozole from his truck.
So, ustedes son activistas por inmigrantes aquí en Santa Fe. ¿Cuáles son los problemas que tienen los inmigrantes aquí en Santa Fe? What are the problems that immigrants in Santa Fe are facing today?
Ahora tenemos algunos problemas con redadas de migración, que eso es lo que está pasando más frecuente ahora.
Immigration raids.
Y pues en realidad, de todos modos, gracias a la ciudad de Santa Fe, que siempre hemos sido bienvenidos.
Santa Fe has always welcomed us.
Y pues en realidad los problemas pasan, pero Santa Fe ha sido una ciudad muy generosa con los emigrantes, especialmente con los jornaleros.
Santa Fe has been a very generous city despite the problems.
Y pues en realidad le damos gracias a la comunidad y aquí estamos otra vez ayudando a nuestros hermanos latinos que son emigrantes y gracias a toda la gente que el año pasado nos apoyó mucho con nuestra posada.
And here we are helping our brothers and sisters and thanking those who've helped us last year in La Posada. Álvaro?
Buenos días. Pues nada más para invitarlos a nuestra posada navideña que tenemos el día 10 a las 5:30 para nuestros paisanos y amigos jornaleros. Y más que nada para ver, estamos agarrando donaciones de chamarras, lo que ustedes gusten donar para nuestros amigos, que en esa temporada se les viene algo pesado.
So we are gathering gifts for our amigos, for our friends and companions. Mara?
If anybody is expecting to get a new winter coat for Christmas and has an old one to pass on, we would be most grateful for any warm clothes in good condition, especially jackets, caps, gloves, socks, and people with donations could call me at 982-9520, and we can arrange pickup. We would be most grateful for the generosity that your listeners have shown in the past, because the Christmas spirit belongs to all of us. And I can tell you, as I said before, it's cold in the park this morning.
It is cold all over Santa Fe. Well, I want to thank you all very much for being here. Mara Taub, Álvaro Holguín, and Rafael Escamilla. Muchas gracias.
Gracias. Igualmente. Gracias a ti.
We're going to take another little break right now. And when we come back, we'll be talking about the latest exhibition in Los Desaparecidos. Stay tuned to KSFR. I would like now to welcome Juan Manuel Echevarria. He is an artist whose show just opened at the Santa Fe Art Institute, Bocas de Ceniza, Mouths of Ash. Also joining us are Laurel Ryder, who is the curator of Los Desaparecidos, the Disappeared exhibition, which is at Site Santa Fe, and also the curator of this show, which also started at the North Dakota Museum, where Laurel is from, and Diane Karp of the Santa Fe Art Institute, who is making all of this possible. Welcome, ladies and gentlemen.
Good morning.
Good morning.
Hello.
Laurel, we had you on when the show opened, Los Desaparecidos, at Site Santa Fe. And this is also a show that takes on some very heavy and important and often rather painful and disturbing imagery. Where is this coming from in you? Do you like this Latin American expression, or the expression of stuff that usually isn't found in art exhibitions?
I like finding really important art about important things, where artists have reached the peaks of their production and they're making fabulous work, and I think it should be seen by the people. And given where I am in North Dakota, I can do what I please, so I can do these big exhibitions of people no one here has ever heard of.
Now, when you say in North Dakota you can do whatever you want, you couldn't do that in Texas or Los Angeles? Or?
Well, I'd have to answer to boards. Now, all I have to do is find the money. I don't have to go through curatorial committees and convince this one and that one.
So how did you and Juan Manuel find each other?
I was in Bogota installing a painting exhibition by an Uruguayan, and I had read about him in Baum magazine, just a lovely little essay. And I was doing the Disappeared. I was looking for artists, and I asked someone to introduce us, and we had a half hour. And at that point, I saw the work, and I thought it was very, very good. And then a few months later, he invited me back to Cali to see his solo exhibition. And at that point, we looked at each other and said, let's do a big exhibition in the States.
And so what is the relationship between this and the Disappeared work in terms of your organization of these two shows?
Juan Manuel is in the larger exhibition. He has two pieces in that. And when I went to the Warhol Foundation, I took the two exhibitions to them as a pair. And they immediately called me back and said, well, we need one more letter from you. Change the amount you asked for. And I said, what am I supposed to ask for? And they said, ask for 60 instead of 40. I said, do I need a reason? They said, oh, no, just send the letter. So it came as a package in the beginning just for funding reasons.
And in Santa Fe, we have a very interesting thing going on, which is, for example, the solo exhibition by Juan Manuel is at the Santa Fe Art Institute. The solo exhibition by Oscar Munoz opened at the Center for Contemporary Arts. So it's really a chance for people to see in more depth what some of the artists in Los Desaparecidos are doing. Juan Manuel Echevarria, you were a writer and you started making photographs. What was the nature of that transition for you?
Well, in my writing, I was never able to speak about the social conflict that has been has been happening in Colombia for the last 50 years. In my writing, I was looking more for a fantasy world, for a more oniric world. And there was a moment when writing was, the written word was not giving me enough, or I wasn't giving enough to the written word. So I had a transition to photography.
And what were some of your first subjects of photography?
My first subjects, they were really, well, the first series I did in 1996 was some mannequins, beaten up mannequins that I found selling clothes in the streets of Bogota. And what amazed me was that these mannequins, which were completely beaten up, no one would look at them, but everyone would go to look at the clothes they were exhibiting. So I was very taken by that because I saw how...
So in the windows of stores?
In the streets.
Oh, in the streets.
In the streets.
Street markets. Street markets, right.
Right, right. So I was very taken, and I went there a few times, four, five, six times, to take the photographs of the mannequins, and I understood that I had been suffering from an anesthesia, from a prolonged coma, that I had not seen the violence that we're living in the country. So this walk, this is the kind of, it's like the stone that shattered my tranquil waters.
It's a funny thing, and we talked about this with Oscar Munoz on the air the other day. Somehow you don't see the violence, and yet the imagery is all over the media in Colombia.
Yes, yes, but that is the problem. We don't see the violence because it has become such a routine. It's an everyday event. So in an everyday event, you stop seeing it. You get accustomed to it.
And so somehow these damaged figures of people, not people, mannequins, took you out of what you call that coma.
Absolutely.
And what happened next inside of you and in your expression?
Well, let me say that this first series of mannequins, of damaged mannequins, from then on I understood that through my photography I would look for metaphors about violence. So since that first series I have been looking for metaphors about violence. So the journey has continued.
And they're in the exhibition.
Right.
One of the things that happens with the arts is that it gives the viewer a chance to come unprepared for what they're going to see. When you pick up the newspaper, you're expecting to see violence or expecting to see bad news.
True, Jane. That's true.
When you go to an exhibition and the work is beautiful, and that's something that needs to be underlined, all of the work in the exhibition is absolutely beautiful. It's engaging. It's riveting. It invites you in, and it gives you the time and the space to actually suddenly realize what it is you're hearing, what it is you're seeing. And it speaks to the power of the arts, where all the white papers and the reports in the world come to the viewer and the listener in a very different mode. They're not open. When they come to look at art, they open, and what they receive is more powerful than anything.
One of the pieces in the exhibition is a series of photographs, which is about the monuments to public art monuments to violence in Colombia, but you also talk about the, in a way, you're documenting people's indifference to those monuments. They're walking by with their briefcases or having a chat or eating something. And I wondered what you think as I was looking at those monuments, they're incredible. They're very powerful, these sculptures. Do you think that they are, on some level, ineffective and people become, what would you say, indifferent to them, the way they do to violence in the media?
Well, those monuments do not exist. They only they don't exist in the cityscape. Those monuments I made...
Oh, those are yours. Oh, I didn't understand that.
And they're photoshopped in.
They're photoshopped in. Oh,
in
well,
place.
That explains it.
But no, they're photoshopped in place of the civic monuments that existed, whether it was a huge equestrian statue of Simón Bolívar. The point is the people don't look at those statues and they walk by in these constructs. They walk by both the history of the nation and the actualities of the events.
So monument, you know, public sculpture is overtly polite. And I wanted, when I photoshopped these monuments in the emblematic plazas of the city of Bogota, where we suffer the most indifference with the country, I wanted them to stick like fish bones. And of course, they're not monuments to violence. They're monuments to the indifference that keeps the violence going on and on and on.
I think one of, when you talk about indifference to violence, I think one of the things that people face, and I think we have the same problem in the United States, is that you, what feels like indifference or looks like indifference is even more the sense of powerlessness, the sense of what can anybody really do, and if we try to do something, what will happen to us?
Yes, it's a very good question, very valid, but I think we have to have conscience that we have had a war for 50 years. It's in the backyard. It's Colombians killing Colombians. And yet we just continue with life as if nothing has been happening. We have to break this cycle. We have to break the cycle of indifference. And of course, I don't know, no work of art stops a war. Let me say Guernica has never stopped the wars that have been going on in the world, no? But maybe few people, when seeing these monuments, they will think, maybe we'll open up a small space. And maybe questions, because I believe art is an active tool for reflection. And that's how I like to work with my images.
We're talking to Juan Manuel Echevarria, and his work is at the Santa Fe Art Institute, as well as Los Desaparecidos at Site Santa Fe. It's called Bocas de Ceniza. Where does that title come from, Mouths of Ash?
The most important river in Colombia that runs into the Caribbean, where it spills into the Caribbean, is called Mouths of Ash because it was discovered by the Spanish on a Ash Wednesday. And the Spanish rebaptized everything. They erased the original names and rebaptized everything according to their Christian calendar. So that's why it is called Mouths of Ash. But more than a geographic name, I like the metaphoric name.
But also, it's the main river into which so many bodies have been thrown after violence, after massacres, after disappearances. And so these bodies that floated down the Magdalena River to the Mouths of Ash are the symbols of the sort of destruction and violence of the country.
And there is one body of work in the exhibition which is photographs of cemetery memorials marking the bodies of people with no name.
Precisely. That is El Rio Magdalena, and that is a port in El Rio Magdalena. And it is there precisely where we don't have the indifference. So it's very much the opposite of the other monumental pieces.
Right.
Because here, in this mausoleum with the tombs, those bodies that come, that are floating in the river, perhaps many of them, body pieces, mutilated bodies, they are taken by the villagers. They are buried, and then they are adopted. Those NN, no name, people, they are adopted and they're given names, and they come back to humanity by being adopted.
And aren't they being adopted by not wealthy people, the poor people, the ordinary people?
Of course, it's the marginal people who are adopting them.
Who are paying attention.
Who are paying attention. But of course, they are asking for a business-like transaction. NN, the soul of the NN, please help me win the lottery, and I will come and I paint your tomb. I will bring flowers to your tomb.
And one guy, the soul of the nameless person, did help him win the lottery.
Of course. And they help, of course, of course.
Now, you say of course. I mean, we're sitting here in a scientific materialist universe in which people don't necessarily believe that the souls of the dead give you lottery numbers. I mean, what is the... I was thinking when I was looking at this exhibition that there is this phenomenon that is almost universal of human beings feeding water, food, the flowers, the souls of people who have no bodies. What is the nature of that transaction?
Because there is, in this part of Colombia, in Puerto Berrío, there is an old, old tradition where the month of November is the month of the souls. And in the month of November, the cemetery is open always at midnight. And a man hooded in black and dressed in black invites the people of the village. And they do a procession through the cemetery where they knock on the tombs and they ask the souls of the tombs, of the dead people, to come out and be happy and mingle with the living. So this ritual that we are seeing in this mausoleum of adopting the NN comes from a very old religious tradition.
Why do you think it is the poor people in villages that are doing this and not urban people who are better off?
Because the urban people that are better off, well, we live more comfortable lives. And this particularly place, Puerto Berrío, has been a society of terror for 40 years. Last time when I was there, which was this last, when was Halloween? 30th of November?
Yeah, 31st of October,
excuse me. I was in Puerto Berrío, and I was able to see in the cemetery the death, a paramilitary had been murdered, and there was the burial of that paramilitary there. So it's a society that lives constantly with death, but they are reacting against the normality of violence.
And isn't it true in this long civil war, it's the peasants who have suffered the most?
Absolutely, absolutely. That's a very important point.
Yeah.
Of course, all of Colombian society has suffered, but the hardest hit are the peasants. We have 3 million displaced people in Colombia in the last 20 years, and they come from the countryside.
And they're all now in places like Bogota.
Absolutely. They are in Bogota, and what is amazing and horrific is that we stigmatize them, and we don't like to have them around because we feel maybe they were sympathizers with the guerrillas, maybe they were sympathizers with the paramilitaries, and we reject them.
So they can't win, basically.
They can't win.
But also they're reminders of the behavior and the violence in the country and the way in which they have been completely disenfranchised. And the other thing that occurs is that these are the people for whom charity, a good deed, is the right thing to do. They know that the people floating down the river, for the most part, are just like them. And it's a matter of saving and giving a formal burial to someone who might be the equal to your cousin, your mother.
Well, it's a funny transaction that you talk about with that, and we want to talk about some of the other pieces too, but you're saving and giving a formal burial to them and giving them a plaque, but you're also trying to get something.
Of course, but that's on an individual level. If we go to a collective level, if we give it a reading of a collective level, we are seeing these people saying to the perpetrators of violence, you have mutilated that body. You have thrown that body in the river so the vultures will eat it. We will not allow that body to be disappeared. We snatch it from you, the perpetrators of violence. We take it in. We buried him or her, and we humanize that body that you have dehumanized. So really it's about resilience. It's really about resistance against the perpetrators of violence on a collective level. And here you have the weaving of the social fabric, which is so important to a society which has been doing the opposite, ripping apart the social fabric.
And it's no different than Christianity. I'll behave if you let me go to heaven. I'll do this.
Right,
if,
which is the origin
the
of charity at the very beginning.
Yeah.
Now, another piece in the show, some of these songs that are composed and sung and then filmed by survivors of massacres and violent displacement. And they're on view both at Site Santa Fe and a couple more of them in the Santa Fe Art Institute. How were these songs composed? How did you find these people? And were they already singing these songs? Or
look, it was by chance. When you have a focus in life, and my focus is metaphors about violence, well, life brings, I don't know.
Coincidences?
Yes.
Or you see things you wouldn't have seen without it.
correct. I think that's maybe that's the better way to put it. That's right.
It's
that's
destiny.
Right. And I met one of the singers who is at the site Santa Fe. And
one of the two brothers.
It was him that I first met in a small village in the Caribbean Sea, a village called Baru. And it was midnight. I was drinking with some friends. We were partying. And then all of a sudden, this person came, whom I didn't know. And he said he had a song to sing. And we said, let's hear the song. And when I heard the context of the song, which was him giving thanks to God for having saved him from a massacre, I said, can I film you? And he was very honored, and he was very happy. He felt very happy that someone did care about that song that he was singing. So it was that was the first song. And it's very fascinating because he composed this. He was able to run away from the paramilitaries, to escape from the paramilitaries in a horrific massacre where there were 23 people killed. And when he escapes, he goes into a mangrove jungle. No shoes, only a pair of shorts. And the first day he was there, the first night, he had to go into the swamp waters because of all the insects. He couldn't have survived. And inside that swamp, he said, God, if you allow me to survive, I will compose a song to you. And of course, he was saying that to God, so he was asking for the rope that would pull him out of hell. And he composed that song.
And the amazing thing, his brother survived as well.
His brother survived as well, and one of his first cousins did die in that massacre. But when I filmed him, I knew it couldn't be an isolated case, that people must be singing to the violence of Colombia, because I find that it is a very cathartic experience. So it opened a journey into other singing, other singers.
And Manuel, isn't this on the Pacific, in the black culture, probably African, the tradition maybe?
I mean, the African tradition has an oral tradition, which is very important, and a singing tradition.
Yeah, so it could have come.
I have often asked myself if I was to go to Rwanda, if I was to go to other countries where there is deep social conflicts and war in Africa, where there is, of course, is the oral tradition also, if I could also find many singers singing about the war. I am sure there are.
But the thing that's stunning about all of the songs is that they don't ask for justice, they don't ask for retaliation. They simply speak what they saw and thank God for survival.
Well, some of them do, and then there's another one, a man
God,
singing
yeah.
to the president, saying,
oh, yes.
Mr. President, look at this. Do you not know what's happening to your people?
Absolutely, absolutely. It's songs that come out of a deep pain, but no eye for an eye and no vengeance in any of the words they sing.
But right. They do question God, why did you let this happen to me? Sometimes.
Yes.
Well, again,
yeah.
Some of them do, and then some of them say, thank yeah. you, God. And
exactly.
I always
yeah.
wonder with that, you know, one person's thanking God, another person can't because they're dead. I mean, it seems that there's a randomness to who was and wasn't saved.
Absolutely. I mean.
Now, there is another body of work in the show at Site Santa Fe. And by the way, for those who are just tuning in, we're talking to Juan Manuel Echevarria about his exhibition, Bocas de Ceniza, Mouths of Ash, and also curator Laurel Reuter and Diane Karp of the Santa Fe Art Institute. There is another body of work, the La Maria work, about these people, I think it was women, who were kidnapped, taken away by the military. They lived in captivity for some months. And one of the ways they stayed sane was by making certain collections and working with objects and having an interaction with their captors. Tell us a little bit about this story, because the results of this story, including both their testimony and these objects, is in the show.
Yes, it was a kidnapping that took place in a church called La Maria in Cali, Colombia. And it was a guerrilla group called the ELN. And they stormed the church, and they took out 158 people. And then they divided them, because it was such a huge group, into smaller groups. and they were taken into the jungles of Colombia. And I was able to meet in a group. There was a group of 11 people, 8 women and 3 men. And after they were released, I was able to meet a woman, one of them, and I asked her if she would allow me, because she told me that they had collected. They tried to turn the kidnapping into a story of survival, of course, which is natural. But this woman collected, what was very important is that they collected insects, and the insect collection became a bridge of communication between them and the guerrilla boys.
And you say boys, they really were boys. I mean, they were teenagers to some extent.
I asked Melissa, one of the women in this kidnapping, were you afraid of death? And she said, how could we, when our captors were 11, 12, and 13 years old, the ages of my son?
And the thing that you need to remember is that these were women with children who had been kidnapped by children who had been kidnapped by the paramilitary and the guerrillas.
It's amazing. It's an amazing body of work. And also, it's a kind of work that allows the viewer to impose their imagination on it. You don't tell us everything. There's so much that's left up to the heart of the viewer in sort of making up the story. And I found myself imagining what it would have been like, how I would have responded. There's a red cloth that you photograph, and that was the one cloth that they had. And so you're thinking of all the things they did with that cloth and how that cloth was dirty and grubby and how they cleaned it. You don't tell that story. We have to make it up for ourselves.
Yes, and in the exhibition, very important. By the way, that cloth was their communal towel.
Yeah.
Yes, yes. And I have always imagined 5 months, 11 of you.
One towel.
One towel. Imagine all the energy that passes through that towel from one person to the other. And it becomes, of course, a ritual, a communal ritual, I think. That towel was shared by all of them.
In the beginning of the exhibition, we've only got about a minute left, there is a photograph of a white horse. What is the symbolism of that horse?
When I look at that horse, for me that horse has a very humane face. And that horse is always, when I see that horse is asking me, why are human beings so cruel to each other?
And when I see it, I see the country of Colombia itself starving this white horse, and it's starving in the countryside.
And you can see the ribs sticking out of the skin.
Yeah, yeah.
Laurel Reuter, have you been watching people respond to the shows that you've curated? Can you tell what audiences, what kind of transactions are going on?
What I have seen, and I talked to, before the shows open, I talked to the staff about, expect people to cry and expect them to want to tell you their stories, because many, many will have gone through this themselves. And they're finding the audiences here are huge, maybe 3 times what they would normally have, and that people spend up to 3 hours looking at the exhibition. 40 minutes would be a normal walkthrough. It makes people feel. And I think through exhibitions like this, we learn about our own times. And that then you begin to know the stories of your own life.
Laurel Reuter is the curator of Los Desaparecidos, The Disappeared at Site Santa Fe, and Bocas de Cenizas, Mouths of Ash in Site Santa Fe. Juan Manuel Echevarria is an artist from Colombia whose work is at both places, and Diane Karp is the director of the Santa Fe Art Institute. There's a lecture. Why don't you just say it? Tell us about the lecture.
Juan Manuel will be talking about his work and the work that's in the exhibition tonight at 6 p.m.
At Tipton Hall on the campus of the College of Santa Fe. Thank you for being with us.
And we'd love for everyone to come and see it and see the exhibition. Thanks for your show.
Thanks to all of you. You've been listening to the Santa Fe Radio Cafe. My name is Mary Charlotte. KSFR streams live on the web at ksfr.org. You can email me at radiocafe@ksfr.org or leave a message at 428-1528. We're also podcasting at santafe.radiocafe.org, where you can hear the show anytime you want to listen, thanks to Santa Fe's .foil computer services. And you can also subscribe to the show on iTunes. Thanks to Mary Lynn LeBlanc for engineering today. Stay tuned for the BBC, followed by local news by KSFR's award-winning news team. And after that, the colors of jazz. Broadcasting live from the Santa Fe Baking Company, my name is Mary Charlotte. We'll see you tomorrow. Ciao.